Gaines chuckled. Well, I guess that's some relief. He stood and lifted the blinds and opened the window to let a little air into the room. It was still dark outside. I'm glad I was able to introduce you to Joe, he said. I owe that man so much. He saved your life or something? Surratt asked. Back when you were soldiers? No, said Gaines. I mean, yes, I'm sure he must have many times over. But that's not all. He sat beside her at the table. From his wallet, he produced a small, wrinkled photograph, a high schooler's graduation portrait. The girl in the picture had Gaines's smile, his deep-set eyes. Even back then, you could see it coming, said Gaines. Before the first bombs fell, before the slaughter in East Texas, everyone knew this country was getting ready to tear itself to shreds. I was worried for my family, worried about whether I could keep my wife and daughter safe. It was Joe who helped me. He found a safe place for them to live in the Boise. They hated me for sending them away, but they're safe there, and that's the only thing that matters. That's what Joe did for me. That's the gift he gave me. Gaines folded the picture of his daughter and placed it back in his wallet. You know, I'd like to say you remind me of her, or that you two would have been good friends. But the truth is, it's been so long since we've spoken. Maybe if we met now, she wouldn't even recognize me. Maybe all she'd see is some old fool, some foreigner. He seemed then not to be speaking to Surratt, or even to himself, but to nobody at all. He stared out the half-open window. They heard the faint patter of footsteps overhead, the camp's administrators and volunteers preparing for the morning shift. Why did you side with the South when the war came? Asked Surratt. You were born a Northerner. You fought for the Northern Army when it was still one country. Why not side with the Blues? Well, after they finally brought us back from Iraq and Syria for the last time, I wandered around for a while before settling down in Montgomery, said Gaines. You see, we have a habit in this country of deciding the wisdom of our wars only after we're done fighting them, and I guess we decided the war I'd been sent to fight wasn't a very good idea after all. In the North, whenever anyone found out I'd been a part of that war, they'd want to debate it all over again, as though I was the one who ordered myself to go over there. But in the South, they don't do that. Or at least, nobody ever did that to me. So that's it? Asked Surratt. They were good to you here? So you sided with the Red? No, said Gaines. I sided with the Red because when a Southerner tells you what they're fighting for, be it tradition, pride, or just mule-headed stubbornness, you can agree or disagree, but you can't call it a lie. When a Northerner tells you what they're fighting for, they'll use words like democracy and freedom and equality, and the whole time both you and they know that the meaning of those words changes by the day, changes like the weather. I've had enough of all that. You pick up a gun and fight for something, you best never change your mind. Right or wrong, you own your cause, and you never, ever change your mind. So you think we're wrong? Surratt asked. You think what we're fighting for is wrong? No, said Gaines. Do you? No. But if you did, if you knew for a fact we were wrong, would it be enough to turn you against your people? No. Gaines smiled. Good girl, he said. The sound of footsteps grew. Soon they could hear the workers upstairs delineating the day's tasks, who was to oversee distribution of rations, who was to escort the immunization worker around the camp, who had to deal with the South Carolinians. Surratt stood to leave. Hold on, said Gaines. I want you to take something with you. He opened one of the desk drawers. When he turned around, Surratt saw he was holding a small folding knife. He opened it. The blade was of slightly blemished steel and smooth except at its lower end, where it turned to serrated teeth. There was a monogram etched into the handle. Y.B.R. You know how to use a knife? Asked Gaines. pointing the blade toward her. "Everyone knows how to use a knife," said Surratt. "No, everyone knows how to stab." He flipped the knife and offered her the worn leather handle. Surratt turned the knife in her hand. It was light, and its lightness made it seem insignificant. She pushed her finger against the edge of the blade. "It's rusted," she said.
"It's not rusted," Gaines replied. "It's dull. But that can be remedied."
He retrieved a sharpening stone from one of the drawers. The stone was black and rectangular. One of its sides was coarse, the other smooth. He set the stone on the table in front of Surratt, and then he guided her hands until they held the knife against the coarse side.
"Resistance and stress," he said. "All it takes is resistance and stress."
He moved her hands with his. The knife scraped against the stone, even and rhythmic. The sound of it filled the room.
"How do you know when it's ready?"
asked Surratt.
"It's ready," said Gaines. "When it does what you need it to do."
First light came. Surratt said goodbye to her teacher and made for home. Outside, a soft morning breeze lifted swirls of dust off the ground. Surratt looked across the vast sea of tents. They looked not all that different from the ones that littered the background of the old photograph of Gaines and Joe. Maybe all tents looked the same in wartime. In the distance, she saw two refugees fighting. One man, drunk and stumbling, had knocked over the other one's jug of fermenting Joyful. The two men cursed and threw feeble punches at each other, but Surratt did not stick around to watch. It seemed such a petty thing to fight over, so inconsequential. Excerpted from Remarks by Kaseb Ibn Umran, President of the Bouazizi Union, delivered at Ohio State University, June 4, 2081.
"I have tested your patience, speaking for so long on such a warm day. But I want to say this again. The government of the Bouazizi Union has no desire to impose its will on the affairs of any other nation. I believe we are all in agreement that the end of the troubles your country faces will come at the hands of the people who call this country home. Nobody else."
Applause.
"But I also believe that all reasonable people of the world, regardless of race or ethnicity or religion, yearn for the same right to liberty, democracy, and self-determination. These are truly universal human ideals, and what we do today to advance them is the most important gift we leave for our children. Wars are temporary. These principles are not. I remember the first time I came to America, many years ago. I was a young university student, a student at this very campus. At the time, my country was undergoing a bloody but necessary revolution. A revolution that claimed the lives of many martyrs, but granted my people the freedom they had, for almost two centuries, been denied. I remember all the things that fascinated me about America. Its vast and beautifully diverse geography, blessed with some of the most awe-inspiring natural wonders on earth. Its equally diverse people, living alongside one another in peace, regardless of the superficial differences among them. I saw in the people of this country a spirit I had rarely seen elsewhere, a dedication to liberty so overpowering it made of many one."
Applause.
"I say to you now, in closing, that I see that very same spirit here today. Whatever challenges America faces in this troubled moment, I am sure the people of this country can overcome. They have done so many times before."
Applause.
"And they will again. And I say to you that my people, the people of the Bouazizi Union, who decades ago demanded from their rulers the very same liberation your revolutionaries once demanded of theirs, stand ready as allies to assist in any way we can. We are, all of us on this earth, drawn instinctively to peace. And I believe peace will prevail. Thank you, and God bless America."
Applause.
Chapter 8 2 days before the massacre, there was a heavy storm. It lasted from dawn to dusk, the gray-muddled clouds oscillating between torrent and trickle. The hardest rain came early. By the time a convoy of Free Southerners' trucks arrived with sandbags, many of the camp's older tents had already washed away. The refugees sought shelter in the administrative buildings. Outside, in the stream of mud and wastewater, a doomed armada of clothes and cooking implements and irreplaceable keepsakes floated helplessly. The runoff fed into the ditches, and beyond the ditches, the creeks, and beyond the creeks, the now roaring Tennessee. As the Free Southerners packed the sandbags along the banks of Emerald Creek, cursing and gagging at the smell of the overflowing filth, Surratt and her girls chased after the water-swept mementos. Soaked to the bone, they scooped up anything of practical or sentimental value. Picture frames, coils of fishing line, flags of the state and of the rebels, and keys. Most important of all, keys. The girls worked solemnly. At Albert Gaines's urging, Surratt had, a few weeks earlier, started a small club of sorts, her very own version of a scout troop. Already she'd wrangled 4 young recruits, the Singletary sisters from Alabama, Charlie from Georgia, who went by her dead younger brother's name, and Nadine from Mississippi. 2 months before she arrived at Patience, Nadine lost her lower jaw in a bird strike on Holly Springs. In its place now was a mash of mangled skin and a metal plate that held together what was left of her jawline. Nadine didn't speak. Of all the girls, she was Surratt's favorite. When the girls' satchels were full, they took the contents to the administrative buildings. There, Surratt unlocked the side door and led them down the stairwell to the hallway leading to Gaines's office. In the hallway, they set the salvaged items down on towels to dry, and then they returned to work. By sundown, the rainfall started to ease. A couple of hours later, it was little more than a sprinkle. Surratt ran to the northernmost tents and watched the low gray clouds fall back to the blue country. In the north, the tents were new and largely unused, but none of the refugees had sought shelter there. The next morning, Surratt instructed the girls to begin taking the salvaged debris out of the hallway. Her recruits laid their findings out on the ground by the side of the building. By the time the camp staff became aware of what the girls had done, a mass of refugees had descended on the impromptu lost and found. They sifted for things they thought were gone forever, and when they found them, they cried and hugged the girls and called them angels. By noon, there was not a single item left unclaimed. Martina Chestnut stood for a long time in front of her pristine tent. She observed the corners where the fabric hugged the scaffolding. There wasn't a single tear, not even a sign that a rainstorm had come through at all. The ground surrounding the tent was a thick stew of mud, and all her neighbors' homes were collapsed or nearing collapse, but Martina's home was untouched. For a moment, she was taken with thoughts of divine providence. She began to entertain the notion that some higher power had held its cupped hand over her home. Surely it was no mere chance. Surely she had suffered enough to warrant this small act of mercy. Of course, others had suffered. Some arrived at the camp missing limbs or sight or kin, and some were nothing but hollow shells in the shape of the living. But she had suffered too. She had suffered too. Inside, she found Surratt and Dana on their cots, reading. Dana held a tablet. On the screen there was a Tumble magazine feature on Black Sea Chic and the newly resurgent fashion scene of the far northern Bouazizi. Surratt sat upright on her cot, an old southern history book in her hands, on loan from Gaines.
"How did you two get back here so fast?"
Martina asked. She breathed in deeply. The air inside the tent smelled bittersweet and acrid, a chemical scent.
"She was out all night saving everybody's trash," Dana said. "I was in here." "Why didn't you come to the building?"
Martina asked.
"This whole tent could have been swept right out in the storm."
Dana chuckled.
"You kidding? Simon and a couple of his friends came by a day ago and sprayed the whole thing down. They got chemicals that make the water bounce right off of anything. Makes it like it never rained at all. It was a loud storm, though, I'll tell you that. Barely got any sleep."
Martina observed her other daughter, who had yet to take her eyes away from the pages of her book.
"You knew about this?"
she asked. Surratt shrugged. Martina fell silent.
She walked past her daughters to her own room. In the last year, the woman and her twin daughters had come to occupy the entirety of the tent, as Simon had taken to living outside the camp, only returning for a night or two every few months. On her bed, Martina found another care package from her son. It was a cardboard box that had once held a kitchen mixer. Its top flaps were sealed tight with packing tape. Martina lifted the box. It felt heavy, perhaps 20 pounds. Without opening it, she carried it past the blanket curtain to her daughter's room. She set it beside Surratt's bed. "Take this and give it to the people who lost their tents," she said. "What's in it?" Surratt asked. "I don't care. Just give it to someone who needs it." "There's lots who need it. You want me to stay in Mississippi, or..."
"Just do it, Surratt."
"All right." Martina went back to her room and lay on her bed. The sheets were cool, and the pillow felt good against the back of her neck. Soon, the girls heard snoring from behind the curtain. Dana, lying still on her cot, cast an eye at her sister.
"Go on, then,"
she said. "She's going to change her mind when she wakes up," Surratt replied. "She'll want it back.
And she'll get mad at you if it's still there. Open it up. Let's take some of it and tell her we haven't given away the rest yet. Then everybody's happy."
Surratt retrieved from a sheath in her pocket the small folding knife Gaines had given her. When she first received it, the blade was dull, but she had scraped it against the sharpening stone night after night. Now, the blade was rough and uneven from being overworked, but Surratt mistook this for sharpness. She slit the tape and opened the care package. She picked the first items she saw inside, a couple of stunted, blue-grown oranges, and tossed one to her sister. Dana pierced the skin with her fingernail and held the fruit to her nose and inhaled deeply.
"They must have gone all the way up to Virginia for these," she said.
Surratt shook her head. "Simon says they've only been fighting around the southern end of the Smokies. Picking out those militias around there, get any further north and the blue soldiers proper will get you."
"Can't grow these in Tennessee," Dana said. "Too hot. Gotta be Virginia, at least.
They don't go get them where they're grown. They just pick them up at the ports in Augusta. You can get whatever you want there. Stuff you can't even get in Atlanta." Dana smirked.
"What do you know about all that? You can't even point Augusta out on a map."
"Yeah, I can. And it's true. Nobody keeps track of what's on those charity ships. You can steal half the boat before anyone notices."
Surratt sifted through the rest of the package. She tossed a small can of cashews to her sister and kept a packet of apricot gel for herself. She set aside a tube of superglue and a roll of twine and some knitting supplies to hand out to other refugees, and left the rest for her mother.
"Hey, give me some of those," Dana said, pointing to a small container of painkillers.
"Mama doesn't need those."
"Nobody needs those," Surratt replied.
"They're for broken bones. What have you got that needs these?"
"I got bored," Dana said, raising her feet to the air and flicking her toes at the ceiling.
"I got 10 broken bones worth of board."
Surratt observed her sister on the bed. She seemed younger somehow. For as long as she could remember, Surratt had felt that her twin had a head start on her, an innate understanding of what it means to be grown up. But in the last few months, she had come to feel the opposite. Now, Dana suddenly seemed to her impossibly juvenile, and the things that held her interest girlish and trite. Surratt set the painkillers in the package and then slid the box under her bed. She turned back to her book. Dana picked at her orange, savoring each segment and setting a strip of the fruit's skin atop her upper lip like a mustache. She hummed the first bars of a popular Redgrass song called "Julia's Right," which the summer prior had been the biggest hit in all the mag and was universally banned anywhere north of the Tennessee line. The song was by a country star named Sherilyn C., after whom Surratt had named her pet turtle. Dana turned once more to her sister.
"So, when are we going to tell Mama?" she said.
"Tell Mama what?"
"You know what. About you and me going away. About Atlanta."
Surratt sighed.
When she had first told her sister her ambition to one day travel to the southern capital and work with the government of the free southern state, Dana had chuckled at the thought. "What use do you think they have down there for a refugee girl from Louisiana?" she'd said. "You gonna run for president, too?" But as the months passed and the camp continued to fill well beyond its capacity, its occupants subjected daily to new and varied indignities, the idea of running to the city began to appeal more and more to Dana. She started boasting to her friends about it, until Surratt regretted ever having told her anything about Atlanta. "We're not just leaving our mother here and running away," Surratt said.
"Who's going to take care of her?"
"Simon's been taking care of her just fine," Dana said, pointing at the box under Surratt's bed. "Simon doesn't spend more than one night a month in this tent. You know that."
"So what? We're just going to live the rest of our lives in this place? Wait for another storm to come and wipe the whole place away? Or the birds to come by and bomb it to hell? I thought you had all these plans about working for the government, letting the world know what the North's been doing to us, all that stuff. You keep talking about how you're going to change things. You can't change a damn thing living in patience."
"We're going to go, Dana. I promise. But we got to think about our people, too." Dana snorted.
"Our people? In this camp? Are you kidding me? You think if it weren't for everyone knowing Simon was with the rebels and you now being Albert Gaines' pet, they wouldn't have come through here and stolen every damn thing we got? Ain't nobody in this camp our people. Only thing we got in common is we all on the losing side of the same war."
"We're not losing the war," Surratt said.
"I'm not Gaines' pet."
"Come on, girl. You spent every damn night with him. He's got you reading all those books and running all those errands. You know well as I do he's just an errand boy for all them rebel groups. Comes to places like this looking for anyone dumb enough to strap on a farmer suit and blow themselves up outside some northern checkpoint. Won't be long before he tries to put a farmer suit on you, too."
"He's a teacher," Surratt said. "Nothing more."
Surratt stood up. She lifted her messenger bag off a hook on the wall and slung it over her shoulder. "I'm gonna go look for Simon out by the creek," she said. "It's getting around sundown. They should be coming in. Don't tell Mama nothing about Atlanta. And don't take any of those pills."
The air smelled of mildew. Everywhere there were signs of damage from the storm, but also signs of recovery. With nowhere else to turn to, the refugees began to rally around the rain-damaged tents like antibodies to an infection. On her way to the northeastern end of Alabama, Surratt passed countless lines of clothes and sheets and flags and blankets, all drying in the wind. Tablets and radios and phones planted like seeds in bags of rice. The sky was a matte purple. Another warm, dry evening was coming over the mag. The puddles began to dry. She walked through the northern tents, where there were some signs of damage, but no signs of life. She passed the tent in which her pet turtle lived, and reminded herself to check on the animal later. When she approached the remains of Highway 25, she saw a man and a boy, both hunchbacked with heavy baggage, walking north toward the ruined bridge and the gate to the Blue Country. She approached and saw that it was Marcus Exum and his father. The two carried overstuffed packs on their backs and grocery bags in their hands, and the father wore around his neck a pair of birding binoculars. Surratt watched them for a minute as they approached the place where the road once crossed low over the creek. Before the war, the road ran straight into Tennessee, but now the only things visible above the waterline were two slim concrete barriers that once marked the edges of the highway. They peered just above the surface like stone tightropes. In the distance, beyond a series of large red signs prohibiting passage, the razor-wired fences and tree-camouflaged sniper's towers marked the beginning of the Blue Country. Surratt approached Marcus and his father. When the man saw her, he turned hurriedly to see if there were others watching, and when he saw none, he motioned for the girl to leave.
"What are you doing?" Surratt asked.
"It doesn't matter to you what we're doing," he said. "Go on now. This doesn't concern you."
"It's all right, Dad," Marcus said, setting his grocery bags down.
"Let me just say goodbye."
"No time," his father said. "They'll be back at the gates soon."
"Just 1 minute. Promise."
Marcus eased his backpack from his shoulders. He'd grown a little in the last year, but still stood only as high as Surratt's chest. He put his hand on her arm.
"We're leaving, Surratt,"
he said. We're going to the north tonight. We're not coming back.
Are you crazy?
Surratt said.
You go anywhere near that gate, they'll shoot you dead.
Marcus shook his head.
Dad's been watching. There hasn't been a single guard at the gate in the last 2 days. Not one blue soldier anywhere along the fence. I don't know where they've gone, but they've gone.
Surratt looked out at the gate in the distance. The foliage-covered towers and the old chicanes looked the same as they always did.
Something's going to happen, Marcus's father said. They're getting ready to storm the fence. They're getting ready to finally come through here.
You've been saying that for years,
Surratt said.
They've been getting ready for years.
Surratt turned to Marcus.
You were just going to go like that? Without even saying goodbye? I knew you were busy with what you've been doing,
Marcus said.
We haven't really talked much in the last little while. I didn't want to bother you. But you're my best friend,
Surratt said. Marcus turned from her gaze, his eyes to the ground.
Pick your bags up, Marcus's father said. We got no time to stand around.
She watched Marcus pick up his belongings. One of the grocery bags was weighted down with ration packs and a water thermos and a couple pairs of underwear. The other had a headlamp and a small camping stove.
You'll take care of Charlene, right?
Marcus said. Surratt nodded.
Don't tell nobody, Marcus's father said. They'll come back and kill us all if everybody starts trying to get through.
She watched the man and his son as they traversed the concrete tightrope to the forbidden country. The path jutted only a few inches above the waterline and was a little more than a foot's width across. They walked carefully, their arms occasionally rising from their sides in an effort to keep balance. As she watched them pass the warning signs, Surratt waited for the sniper's rifles to ring out, for the man and his son to fall dead in the river. But no shots came. Soon, they crossed past the chicanes and disappeared into the brush. Surratt stood for a long time after they were gone, watching the unmoving land on the other side of the water. She tried to imagine where her friend and his father would go. Perhaps beyond the brown and scrubby ridge there lay bustling northern towns brilliant with electric light, or vast fragrant rows of farmland full of oranges and mandarins and exotic blue-grown fruit of which she'd never even heard. Perhaps the two pilgrims would find refuge working in one such farm, or maybe their accents and sun-cracked skin would give them away, and they'd be shot dead at the gates of the very first town. And as she imagined these possibilities, Surratt thought of something else. Of desertion. Of treason against one's own. But what the man and his son had done didn't feel to her like treason. Only the grim work of the hopeless. As she'd learned from Albert Gaines about her people's history of mistreatment at the hands of the North, Surratt had grown to loathe the enemy nation beyond the Tennessee line. But in this moment, as she watched her closest friend disappear into that alien land, she wished only that he be safe there. That he live. That he simply live. After Marcus and his father disappeared behind the distant foliage, Surratt walked east in the direction of Chalk Hollow. The rebels were at the edge of the creek. She heard them before she saw them, a cackle of singing and laughing and loud conversation. Usually they were quiet when they came in across the creek at dusk, but this evening they made no effort to hide their presence. They were Simon's clan, the Virginia Cavaliers. But in reality, there was nothing much to distinguish them from the Mississippi Sovereigns or the New Zouaves or any of the other rebel groups. They were simply boys with guns, fanned out across the border, picking fights with Northerners. She found them, about a dozen in all, at a clearing a few hundred feet past the broken highway. They had come over on 3 Seatocks and a larger fossil-powered skiff, all of which were docked now in the sandy beachfront, partially hidden among the sweet gum trees. Beside the boats, the men were unloading box crates sealed shut with nails.
"Hey, Surratt!"
yelled a half-drunk cavalier named Eli, a boy of about 19 who'd come to the camp from Dalton 4 years earlier.
"Hey, Simon! Your sister's here!"
"Yell a little louder," said Simon, lying on the sand with his back against the black-painted hull, the lapping creek water at his feet.
They didn't hear you in Tennessee.
Eli was perched over a small bonfire, grilling. A set of thick steaks sat atop the fire on a charred cookie tray, the flames licking at its underside. The juice of fat and blood set the fire dancing. The tinder crackled and burst.
Where did you get that meat?
Surratt asked.
One of their generals was kind enough to hand it over,
said Eli, a wide smile across his face. He was missing one of his upper incisors. His hair was unwashed and matted across his forehead in an oily wave. Like the others, he went days without cleaning himself. But on this evening, the reek of him was overwhelmed by the warm sweetness of the fire and the intoxicating scent of grilling meat.
You know those pigs up there? They eat like this every night, said Eli. Girl, tell me, when did you last eat steak like this?
Maybe once, back in Louisiana, said Surratt. Never had it here.
Those pigs eat it every single night, said Eli.
He leaned down and cut a piece of the steak. It was dense with fat and severed easily under the blade of his bowie knife. He handed it to Surratt. She chewed it slowly, savoring the warmth and the way the marbled flesh both gave and resisted against her teeth. The taste of wood smoke was thick in the charred exterior, the meat beneath it pink and tender. How could it ever be, thought Surratt, that a person could eat this well every day and not die from the very shame of it, when just a few miles away there lived so many subsisting on so little?
You gotta be careful, said Surratt. They smell that in the camp. They'll come running.
Oh, we got some for them, too,
said Eli, pointing at the crates along the bank.
We can't go around handing it out like it's Christmas or nothing, but we'll get it to them. God knows they deserve it.
Eli pierced the steaks with his knife and turned them over. The fire hissed and set its curled fingers upward. He leaned close to Surratt over the flame.
Hey, are those Southern State boys they sent up here after the storm still around?
He asked.
Nah, Surratt replied. Soon as the rain stopped, they were gone.
That's good, Eli said. God damned if they're gonna get any of this. Let them go back to Atlanta. They get fed well enough there.
So, did you steal this, or what?
The smile momentarily left Eli's lips. He was a scrawny boy. All the rebels seemed to either be scrawny or muscle-bound, never regular set. And the orange glow of the fire put dark shadows in the hollows beneath his jaw.
Didn't steal nothing, he said. We fought them for it, and we won. You've been watching too many of their shows, reading too much of their news. They have you thinking they can't ever be beat. Well, they can. Take away their tanks and their birds and all those toys they hide behind like cowards, make it so it's just us and them eye to eye, and they can be beat.
Calm down, Surratt said. I didn't mean nothing by it.
Eli's smile returned.
I know you didn't, girl. Hell, I heard you're learning from Gaines now.
He laughed.
And he loves you. Says you got more balls than most men out here.
Eli sliced one of the steaks widthwise.
Here, he said. Take half of mine.
Surratt thanked him. She walked to where her brother sat at the creekside. A couple of rebels sat nearby on a felled log, playing guitar and singing an old folk song whose popularity had recently been revived by some firebrand folk star in Atlanta who set the old music to new lyrics. The boys, drunk on joyful, slurred the words and cackled at their own musical ineptitude. The one playing the guitar stumbled through four open chords with uncoordinated fingers, muting half the strings.
Mama, take this flag from me. Ain't my country anymore.
Surratt sat on the sand beside her brother.
Hey, lady, he said.
He had a goofy grin on his face, a half-empty jug of Joyful beside him. The drink's reek hung over the beach, a honeyed perfume of fruits left to rot, old bread, creek water, and whatever else the boys could find to give the dark juice muscle, from antifreeze to turpentine to ground-up painkillers.
You're celebrating something, I hear,
Surratt said.
You could say that, her brother replied. I don't mean to put a damper on it, but Mama's mad at you.
What's she mad at me for? Didn't that stuff we sprayed on her tent work?
Yeah, but she thinks you should have sprayed it on everybody's tent. Thinks her neighbors are all looking at her funny because all their tents collapsed, but hers looks good as new.
Simon chuckled and spat.
What'd she think? We got time to spray everybody's tent down? Anyway, tell her we're coming around tomorrow to help all those folks fix the place up. Just couldn't be there when the Free Southern State soldiers were there, or else we'd have to put those government boys in their place. And then the blue reporters would have a field day saying, look how the South's fighting itself.
Simon poured a capful of hooch from his jug and offered it to Surratt. When she reached for it, he swooped in with his own mouth and smiled.
Very funny, said Surratt. That stuff will make you blind anyway.
If it's any good, it will, said Simon.
He dug his heels into the sand and watched the boys singing on the log nearby. He'd grown in the last year. Not taller, she still had 3 inches on him, but bulkier. In the rebel camps out by the banks of the Tennessee, he and some of the cavaliers passed the time curling milk jugs full of sand. He had biceps on him now like rolling hills. Surratt envied the malleability of boys' bodies, the way they could, while still boys, cast their physical shapes forward into adulthood like reconnaissance scouts. All her life, she'd had little interest in the working of boys' minds, which she imagined only as a set of flimsy pinwheels turning in the direction of obvious things. But she longed to have such a malleable, predictable body, one that could grow big and strong and yet not raise a single stranger's eyebrow. In the amber glow of firelight, the boys sang drunkenly. Simon turned to his sister.
We got one of them yesterday, Surratt, he said. We got a big one.
Who?
Surratt asked.
A guy named Pearson, said Simon. A general, commander of half the troops along the Tennessee line.
Jesus.
How?
We were out in the forest, all the way out east, past Chattanooga. We'd been there for days, camped out by a path the Blues had been using to run supplies in and out of Big Frog. Eli set a trap, a big mine deep in the ground, a little mine just above it. The big mines don't go off under the weight of a man, but the little ones do. So you make it so that one sets off the other. Then we lay a tree trunk across the path, and we just waited. Waited for 3 days, till finally this convoy comes rolling through. Usually they run in fours, but this time it was just two laughs. We thought it was just grunts rotating through the forward base at halfway branch, but when they came out to take a look at the log, well, Eli's looking through the binoculars, and he says, one of them got stars on his shoulders. And we're watching as he walks out ahead of all of them, like he's making a big show of leading, and he steps right on it. The little mine sets off the big mine and takes all but two of them out right there. We came running down there as soon as it went off, and in the back of these labs were nothing but crates of supplies, so many we couldn't even carry them all.
Simon pointed to the sky.
I'm telling you, he was watching over us, Rat. He was watching over us. I know it.
Simon, you can't be out here celebrating, said Surratt.
You gotta hide. They'll come after you.
Simon laughed.
Who are they gonna come after? They don't know nothing. All they know how to do is build walls and send the birds to do their dirty work for them.
You gonna keep all this stuff in the camp?
Most of it is just food, said Simon. We're gonna keep some of it up north in the empty tents, but most of it we'll just give out. People deserve to eat.
They'll know, said Surratt.
Word will get out. You can't have a whole camp eating steak and nobody hears about it.
It'll be all right,
Simon said. He put his arm around his sister and pulled her close to him, her smooth-shaved head resting against his shoulder.
Christ, lady, when did you get so nervous? What happened to the girl who jumped into Shit Lake on a dare?
Just be careful.
We got one of theirs, Surratt, said Simon. Every day they get 100 of ours, but this time we got one of theirs.
Surratt returned to the center of the camp. She entered the administrative building through the side door that led to Albert Gaines's office. On this night, she found him leaning over the table, placing delicate spoonfuls of something black and glistening on a plate. He was dressed as she'd always seen him dressed, his single-breasted suit unblemished by wrinkles. He wore a double Windsor tie of matte gray, decorated with a crest of three stars atop an armored knight's head and a red-striped shield. His hat lay on the table.
"Come in, come in,"
he said, smiling.
"I have something special for you."
Surratt inspected the small, flat canister on the table. Its tin lid had been pried open, and inside lay a clump of small black balls. The writing on the side of the canister was foreign, letters similar to English but oddly misshapen, as though mutated somehow. The logo on the label was of a fish and a king's crown.
"In Columbus, the northerners pay more than you would ever believe for pale imitations of this,"
Gaines said.
"Tonight, you get the real thing for free."
Surratt poked it with her pinky finger. The amount on her plate seemed impossibly small for a meal, and she wondered if it wasn't some kind of vitamin pill, like the ones that came in the aid shipments.
"What is it?"
she asked.
"Try it first. I don't want you to be disgusted beforehand."
"I won't be."
"It's caviar," Gaines said. "Fish eggs."
"Hmm."
Surratt tasted the caviar. It whispered to her tongue an awful, briny secret. It spoke of something very far away, fruit of alien trees. Instantly, she loved it.
"Where did you get this?"
she asked.
"The Russian Union," Gaines said. "The other side of the world. A present from our friend Joe."
He walked to the office's small kitchenette. Surratt heard the tick-tick-tick of the toaster oven, and soon he returned with her favorite, honey on toast. He sat beside her and watched her eat. He seemed to have an endless capacity for watching.
"I have a new book for you," he said.
He went to the bookshelves and returned with a hardback. Surratt inspected the book. It was brand new, as though it had been published that day. The book was called A Northern Soldier's Education in War and Peace. It had a picture of a handsome man on the cover. Most of the books Gaines had given her to read until then had nothing on their covers but the names of the authors and the names of the books, but on this one, the image of the man dominated the cover, as though his face itself were the subject of the book. The portrait of the man was cropped at his chest. Surratt saw the medals and marks of a military uniform on him.
"The man who wrote this book is named Joseph Weiland, Jr.," said Gaines. "He's the son of the Blues' most senior general."
"What do I have to read a northerner's book for?"
asked Surratt.
"It's all lies, anyway."
Gaines pointed at the picture on the cover.
"This man, quite recently, decided to run for office. And it's customary that when a man like him runs for office, he puts a whole lot of words on a whole lot of pages and stamps his picture on the cover and sends it out into the world. That way, by the time Election Day comes around, a very well-manicured version of himself has already been foisted onto the people who do the electing. But that's not why we read it. We read it because he's our enemy. And half that book that's supposed to be about him, it's really about us. Because we're his enemy. We read it to read beneath it. And in doing so, find out what it is about us that scares him."
Surratt watched Gaines intently. She loved to hear him speak, loved the cadence of his voice and the vast unseen world of which his diatribes so often hinted. Even when she lost track of what he meant, even when she failed entirely to understand him, she smiled and listened and wished only for more. Gaines rose from the table.
"I have one more thing for you," he said.
He retrieved something from his briefcase, and then he was behind her, his hands and what they held brushing against her neck. It was a hemp necklace made of black and white and red threads pearled tight. He clasped it around her neck and gave her a small hand mirror. She looked at her reflection. The necklace felt rough and worn against her skin.
"What's it mean?"
she asked.
"It used to belong to my daughter," Gaines said. "I want you to have it."
"Thank you."
The girl looked in the mirror a while, and for a moment she no longer saw the necklace, only the old man's hands on her shoulders. The knuckles weathered and cracked, the fingernails cut down to the nub. His palms seemed to radiate, and the heat slowly filled the space between Surratt's shoulder blades and spilled down her back. Before he let her leave, Gaines gave Surratt more envelopes to distribute among the refugees. He paid her in advance for the errands. She slipped the crisp Northerner's currency into her messenger bag and bid her teacher goodbye. At night, she made her rounds. By dawn, she was back in her tent. There, for the last time in her life, she slept soundly. When she woke in the afternoon, Surratt saw her tent was empty, her mother and sister gone. She sat up and reached under her bed for the box of rations. She retrieved the tube of apricot gel from her bedside drawer and squeezed some of the saccharin paste into her mouth. A few minutes later, the grogginess disappeared. She changed into her jeans and an Oriskum t-shirt and left the tent. Outside, the refugees were busy fixing their homes, assisted now by a few of the rebels. The smell of mildew hovered in the air, but also the smell of steak and the sound of singing and pleasant, drunken conversation. All the acrimony of a day earlier seems now to have melted away. Men and women sat on chairs and tables made from sandbags, drinking joyful and eating meat with their bare hands, the juice running down their chins. Surratt joined them for a few hours, and for a few hours she was well-fed and happy and a little drunk. In the evening, after the alcohol had worn off, she walked north to check on her pet. When she arrived, she saw the same empty tents of northern Alabama, but beyond them, something was different. The massive floodlights of the blue checkpoint to the north were alight, their beams blanketing a million shadowed outlines in the ground ahead. Surratt hid behind one of the tents and peered out, watching. She saw the men at the gate. Hundreds, perhaps a thousand, clad in black, their faces covered. They arrived in a sloppy formation of old trucks, carrying rifles and pistols and machetes. In the floodlight, the men appeared as shifting inkblots, black limbs on black torsos. In their totality, their movement was of a single squirming organism, writhing under and through the gashes in the fence. She saw them, and at once she knew. As the men approached, Surratt sneaked out from behind the tent and sprinted back into the heart of the camp. She ran in the shadow of the tents, faster than she'd ever run before, the air a maelstrom in her lungs. Where she saw men and women, she screamed at them to run, to hide. She said the militias were coming, but no one seemed to listen. As she approached her tent, Surratt heard the first crack of gunfire. Not the distant rifle shots she'd become acquainted with over the years, but a close burst, a deafening metal rattle. And then she heard shouting, a high-pitched scream. More shots, this time closer. Surratt burst through the door to find her sister sitting on the bed, tablet in hand. She was watching footage of a charity concert in Kennesaw to benefit the mothers of the Southern Republic. The old country star Sherilyn C. sang her hit song. Dana sat on the bed, eating Virginia oranges and singing along.
"You remember how we used to go nuts for her back when we were little?" Dana said.
Then she saw her sister's face.
"What's wrong?"
"The militias are here," said Surratt. "They broke through the northern gate."
"How many?"
asked Dana.
"Hundreds. Get up, quickly. Where's Mama?"
"I don't know. Playing cards at Erica Yarber's tent, maybe? Maybe out with Lara? I don't know. I don't know."
Surratt grabbed her sister by the arm, and together they ran from the tent. Outside, the sound of gunfire echoed, its source ever closer. Some of the refugees stepped out of their tents and asked about the commotion, but this time, Surratt said nothing. She led her sister to the administrative building's side door and unlocked it with Albert Gaines's key. She locked the door behind them, and they ran down the stairs to the office in the basement, turning the hallway lights off as they went. When they were inside the office, Surratt and Dana pushed one of the large bookshelves against the office's front door, and then the table against the bookshelf. Surratt turned off the lights in the room. She led her sister to the closet, and then made to leave.
"No, no, you can't go out there,"
Dana said, holding onto her sister's arm.
"I gotta go find Mama," Surratt replied. "I'll nudge the shelf and the table enough to open the door a little, and then you push it closed behind me."
"Please, please,"
Dana begged.
"You know you won't find her before they find you. They'll kill you out there. I can't lose my whole family. I can't lose everyone I love. Please don't go out there."
Surratt looked at her sister, astounded not by the black glistened tears on her face or the panic in her voice, but at the dark calculation she'd already made. Surratt led her sister into the closet. They huddled together on the floor. The gunfire grew closer, screams drowned in its echo. It came at times in a rapid back and forth. Sometimes there were only single shots, or a parade of single shots, short silences between them. The sounds continued into the night. Then in the earliest morning hours came a brief pause. And in that silence, Dana, exhausted and delirious with fear, slept. Surratt remained by her sister's side. In the blackness, the twins were only the hushed sigh of their breathing, the rise and fall of their chests. Outside, the sound of gunfire had faded, but there were still other sounds. Surratt listened. Boots against dirt. A militiaman asking something unintelligible and his superior responding.
"You know exactly what to do."
The sounds of pleading, of cursing. A line of feet shuffling in unison, drawn closer, closer. Ordered to kneel. More pleading. A man saying,
"I'm not with them. I swear, I swear."
His voice coming through the walls of the building in which Surratt hid, clear as though he were pressed against it. Then nothing. Then a line of single gunshots, one after the other. Then nothing. The shots were closer than any that had come before, and for a moment, Surratt believed the men had entered the building.
"If it's going to happen, then let it happen," she thought. "But I won't die crouching."
She eased quietly away from her sleeping sister. She pulled her folding knife from her pocket and stood up. She eased the office door open just enough to slide through, then she closed it behind her. The corridor that led from the office to the stairs was dark, and the walk seemed endless. As she approached the door, she tried to imagine what the killers looked like. She pictured them as the Northerners she'd seen on television, who always appeared tall and muscular, their complexions ghostly. In her mind, they were of a different breed, a different species. She climbed the stairs to the building's side door, and she put her ear to the door and listened. There was no sound. She opened the door and peered outside. For a moment, she believed she'd mistimed the day. She had thought it was 2 or 3 in the morning, the slaughter closing in on its 24th hour, but the sky above was midday bright. Then the light began to fade, quickly, giving way to a black sky. It stayed dark until, from somewhere far to the north, she heard the whistling arc of another flare, and soon the fraudulent daytime illuminated the camp once more. Surratt walked slowly, keeping near the wall. There were sounds of men cursing in the distance to the southeast and southwest, in Georgia and South Carolina. There were sounds of chaos, too, of tents being torn apart, of women muffled mid-scream, sounds of gunfire, but not as rapid or sustained as it was a day earlier. A great fire burned in the gut of the Alabama slice. The flames curled around plumes of black smoke. There were men in the distance, burning bodies. They brought kindling in the form of tent covers and clothes and mattresses. The fire skipped and cracked and traced higher and higher into the sky. Surratt turned the corner to find a line of bound corpses near the wall. They were men, young and old. They'd been lined up against the wall on their knees, and where the bullets had gone through them, there were splatters of dull red on the wall. Surratt stood frozen. She looked at the bodies. Most lay flat on their fronts or on their sides, facing away from her. but those she could see had grotesque, unrecognizable faces, cracked open at the forehead, contorted in silent agony. The bodies made damp pools in the dusty ground. There was a heat to them. Surratt felt it against her skin, damp and real as steam from a boiling pot. She knew what it was. It was the heat of life extinguished. The heat of something leaving. In the mass of crumpled bodies, she saw a face she recognized. It was Eli, the Virginia Cavalier she'd seen when she went to talk to her brother. Quickly, the faces surrounding him began to register in her memory. They were rebels from her brother's clan. Suddenly, all her courage disappeared. She stood paralyzed with terror, incapable of unseeing the pile of corpses at her feet, among whom she was now certain her dead brother lay. The sounds of burning and of screaming and of killing continued relentless around her, the sky overhead beating dark and light, like God's great heart itself. The sound of men approaching from behind the far corner of the wall shook her from her paralysis. She knew from the soft thud of their boots and from their voices that they were militiamen. She heard one of them say,
"They said there's no rules before sunrise. It's all ours till then."
She knew that when they turned the corner, they'd see her. Without thinking, she fell to the ground. She wriggled into the mass of dead men, camouflaged herself within it. The heat that had touched her body now wrapped itself around her, sunk into her pores. She lay among the blood and sweat and shit and piss of the murdered. She thought nothing of the fluid that seeped into her clothes, or of the odor, or of anything, except her small, desperate prayer. "Please, God, don't let them see me. Don't let them kill me." She held her breath. The footsteps grew nearer. She waited, unmoving as the dead that surrounded her. The men passed. In the stillness that followed, she heard another sound, close by in the tents across the road. It was the sound of guttural heaving, the crack of bone on bone. When that sound subsided, there was another scream cut in half. From a sliver of sight between the limbs of the dead, Surratt saw a man leave the tent across the road. He wore black jeans and a black shirt untucked. His balaclava hung limp from his pants pocket. She saw his face. He looked no different than the men who lived in the camp. He looked no different than anyone Surratt had ever seen. He was of the same species, the same breed. She lay frozen in place and watched the man walk in the direction of Georgia, where there was now another pyre aflame. When he was gone, and she heard no more footsteps, Surratt rose and ran in the direction of the tent from which the man had just emerged. Inside, she saw a woman named Sabrina, a refugee from Mississippi, a survivor of the firebombing of Hopewell. She recognized her, despite the bloody, swollen pulp of her face. The woman's jaw had been shifted violently to the right, the skin around her eyes made puffy and purple. She lay on the floor of her tent with her skirt hiked high and her stomach butterflied open. Her chest moved. When the woman caught sight of Surratt, she raised her hand and beckoned her to come close. Surratt took the woman's hand and sat beside her. The canvas beneath her was soaked. The woman moaned and said a word Surratt could not understand. She took it as a pleading for comfort, and, not knowing what else to do, Surratt reached for a nearby charity blanket and covered the woman's gaping stomach. The woman muttered the same word a few more times and then fell silent. Surratt remained inside the tent. She held the woman's hand, but the hand was now simply weight. She listened as the men returned north toward the gate from which they'd first entered. They passed close to her tent. It seemed an endless procession, thousands strong. She imagined them not as men, not even as human, but as a dark, day-long season, a primal winter. When the footsteps had passed and there was only the distant crackling of fires, Surratt peered out the tent's front door. She saw the wall where the pile of bodies lay. Then came a straggler, a young militiaman with his rifle slung loose over his shoulder. As he passed the dead men, he stopped and faced the wall and unzipped his pants and began to urinate. Surratt watched. She pulled her knife from her pocket and unfolded it.